Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species.
Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with bear expert Elsa Poulsen, author of the book Smiling Bears. We'll talk about her insights into bear behavior and emotions and meet some of the bears she's known. We'll also learn about how she uses her insights to help improve the lives of these majestic creatures. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call comes from a common mammal that lives throughout North America. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess what it is. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation about bears with Elsa Poulsen. Few people know bears as intimately as Elsa Poulsen. She has raised bears, comforted bears, taught bears, learned from bears, had bears communicate their needs to her, and nursed bears back to health. With a bachelor's degree in biological sciences, she has worked at the Calgary and Detroit zoos and is known internationally for her captive bear husbandry and rehabilitation. In 2000, she won the Zookeeper Research Excellence Award from the American Zoo and Aquarium Association's Bear Taxon Advisory Group. She currently works as an animal management consultant for zoos, sanctuaries, wildlife rehabilitators, and other animal welfare groups. She lives in southern Ontario. She's written about her experiences in an engaging book called Smiling Bears that's been shortlisted for the Edna Stabler Literary Award for Nonfiction by a Canadian author. In her book, Smiling Bears, Elsa describes how she approaches every animal with two questions in mind. Who are you? And what can I do for you? These two questions have been the driving force in her work, as she believes it's impossible to effectively care for a bear unless you can answer these questions fully. Today, we'll learn how she goes about answering those questions. We'll learn that, to find out who a bear is, Elsa has had to study the research from the wild, dig up the bear's personal history, and, most importantly, develop a relationship with the animal to have some sense of its expectations. However, as she's learned, a bear will not share his or her thoughts with you if it doesn't know you, or if it knows you but doesn't trust you. Because no two bears are alike, making friends with them is different and difficult each time. Today we'll hear about Elsa's experiences making friends with various bears. In your book, Smiling Bears, you talk about when you first meet a bear, you try to answer two basic questions. Can you tell me about those questions?
They were questions that I just sort of automatically addressed each bear with in my own mind, is who are you? And the second one is what can I do for you? The second one, being a zookeeper, it's not that remarkable. That's my job. My job is to do for you, is to care for you, and how can I do that? And again, I started zookeeping at a time when we were starting to build natural enclosures, but still had a lot of large carnivores who had lived in small cages and so had serious pacing problems and aberrant behaviors and that kind of thing. So the question was really a normal one, is what can I do for you? Obviously, I can help you with your pacing, and how are we going to do that? And so on and on it goes. The first question was, who are you? I didn't invent that. That was something that we really learned through our apprenticeship program, and I learned from some of my old mentors, some of these old guys that I learned from. They would say, well, you know, this is what makes up a bear. This is their history, and no one ever really put it into those terms that I'm saying, you know, there's the three aspects of it. But that's what we worked with all the time. I felt fortunate to have learned zookeeping at the Calgary Zoo because we had the apprenticeship program, and they went to a great deal of trouble to train young people. There was a long, long training period. And that's what we would do. We would look at the natural history when we could, keeping in mind that for polar bears, for instance, a lot of the natural history wasn't even available until the last 15, 20 years. And there are other species that there's not a lot known about them in the wild. So when zoos are criticized for not doing something with a particular animal, you do have to say to yourself, is there a lot of information about that animal in the wild? Well, yeah, if there is a lot of information, then yes, we have to take that information and we have to work with that in the captive community, and there's that level of responsibility. But if there isn't a lot of information about a species, for instance, that's part of a species survival program, or that we're trying to breed in, I don't know, say Swift Fox or something, or Peregrine Falcons. Well, is there a lot of research? Those are two species survival plans that were successful. Is there a lot of information on them? And if it's no, then a lot of this is trial and error. Husbandry is trial and error, right? So the who are you, you have to dig up the their genetic expectations, and that's how they behave in the wild, what they are expecting out of their environment and how they interact with their environment. And then personal history, you would think would be fairly easy to come by, but zoos have really modernized in the last 30 years, progressive zoos, accredited zoos that are accredited by the American Zoological Association or the Canadian Zoological Association, and they're always moving forward. Like, they're always trying to modernize and change. It's not, zookeeping is not a stagnant thing, it's a constantly changing thing. If it becomes stagnant, you're not doing well for your animals. So in the olden days, there, for long-lived animals, there wasn't a lot of history available. People didn't take records. And so you ask, where did this bear come from? Well, I heard this and this, and that's what happened to me when I started in the 80s. I knew bears in their 20s. And the question was, well, what was the story of this bear being brought into captivity? Well, we think it's this, but we're not sure, because this animal was handed down from facility to facility and finally ended up, you know, where you are now. So, but sometimes that would be difficult to come up with. Certainly the last few years that animal had been at, say, the Calgary Zoo or a progressive zoo, that information would be available, but its previous history would not. And then there's the animal's current environment. And again, you would think that would be kind of a no-brainer. But assessing a current environment is only a no-brainer relative to what that animal's genetic expectations are. So if you're housing a polar bear in a cement enclosure, all we really knew about polar bears, for instance, is that polar bears way back when, like 30 years ago or 40 years ago, we knew that polar bears were dangerous. So we built these cement fortresses with 5-foot-thick cement walls to keep these animals in, because we knew that they would kill us if they got out. But we knew little else about them. So that's actually why we built a lot of these cement fortresses, because we were afraid of them. And it's good to be respectful of what this animal is capable of doing. And we do need, in a captive community, in a big city, to keep them confined in a responsible way. There's so much more to that animal and that animal's husbandry. And now that we are getting information from the Arctic, for instance, then we can bring that into the captive community. And that all takes money. So what I always tell people in the captive, visitors to, say, zoos or even some sanctuaries, and those who support rehabilitation efforts, is that you really, if you want to see change, just criticizing the facility isn't good enough. Roll your sleeves up, get in there, and make a difference. Anybody can criticize. Anybody can sit on a fence and criticize. If you want to make a difference for those animals, it's okay if you don't agree with what that particular facility is doing with that animal. Volunteer. They have a volunteer program. Get in there and do something about it. So that's the only way we're going to move forward.
And then when you would meet a bear that you're trying to help, your next step would always be building a relationship. And in your book, Smiling Bears, you say that you're indebted to a grizzly bear named Louise.
Oh, yeah, Louise. Yeah.
Who you say taught you early in your career that a zookeeper's most important tool is a relationship. Can you tell me about Louise and her mate, Kutsi, I think his name was?
Skokie was the latest male in her life. There were other, Louise had experienced other males in her life, in the enclosure that she lived in at the Calgary Zoo. Kutsimatin was, a young animal that was born to a female. Kutumatin was born into captivity. It was sort of an oops moment. Her mother, Florence, was a captive bear, and the Calgary Zoo at that time acted as a facility that would take trouble bears from the wild. They certainly weren't going to breed grizzly bears because that would be irresponsible. Because grizzly bears at the time were not endangered. Now, the grizzly bear population in Alberta has recently been declared threatened, so it may be grizzly bear population may become endangered within the next, you know, number of decades. At any rate, at the time, they weren't breeding them. And so Florence, Kutumatin's mother, was on birth control. And clearly that didn't take. Oops. And Kutumatin was born 1 year, and but Florence was a very old bear, and she died when Kutsi was younger. She was actually young enough to fend for herself in the wild, but in captivity, where Kutsi would stay with her mom, there's sometimes, and there isn't the challenges as there are in the wild, bears sometimes stay cub-like longer. And so when Florence died, Louise was an old female. She was kind of the Aunt Louise. And but when Florence died, Louise took over the mothering of Kutumatin and behaved like Kutumatin. So she adopted Kutsi and told her what to do, and Kutsi behaved like a cub since she had Louise to be her mother. So Louise was one of the smartest animals I've ever met. And she really ran the show in that enclosure, and she tried to keep all the bears and the humans within her influence if she could. And Louise,
how did she do that? What did she do?
She was there, and she, it took some time. Louise always came up to the fence line when I was there. She always came up to the fence line when there were keepers, and she watched human behavior. Even from a distance, she would watch us humans interact with each other and so on and so forth. And I can't tell you a specific time when I knew that Louise and I were communicating, but I can tell you certain events where it furthered my understanding that, yeah, we have some communication going here. I remember being really, Kutumatin was younger, and she pretty much did whatever she wanted in the enclosure, and we had to at one point bring the bears inside overnight, not because we were afraid that they would escape the enclosure, because the enclosure was solid and the bears wouldn't get out, but in the zoo world, sometimes there are people who will try to climb into enclosures. It's silly. They'd be on drugs or alcohol or something stupid. And so we would have to bring them inside or into an area, a back area, where their courtyards were all canopied. And they had access to the building, too, overnight. So at any rate, it was imperative to bring them in. Now, they would be fed throughout the day, so but dinner, of course, would be in the building. And you never hold one animal responsible for another animal. So Louise would come in, but Kutsi wouldn't. And I'd go down, run down the hill, and try to call Kutsi endlessly, and she would hide, and she would dilly-dally, and she wouldn't want to come in, and blah, blah, blah. And I just remember...
Like all kids?
Yeah, she just was driving me crazy, and she wouldn't. But why would she come in? She's a bear. And I had no control over her, none at all. I mean, it's not like I would... We never did anything negative. There was no such thing as negative reinforcement. It was all positive reinforcement. So at best, all you could do was ignore negative behavior. But if you had to bring the animals in, you did your level best to do that. I just remember in frustration, especially when she was hiding, and it's a little unnerving. You cannot go home if you've lost a bear. You can't find her in the enclosure. You know she's hiding somewhere.
So and, they would hide.
Pardon?
They would hide from you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she would hide from you, and that would be great fun. And sometimes she'd come popping up from behind a rock and bounding over to you, like, wasn't that great fun? And you're going, yeah, it's now, you know, half an hour from I should have been going home, but I'm still here trying to find you. And but anyway, this is what it is. But I do remember being really frustrated and looking at Louise going, where's Kutsi? You know, not expecting a response. And Louise looked in the direction of Kutsumatin. And I didn't know Kutsi was there. I would look in that direction, and sure enough, there Kutsi. It's kind of hard to hide her big rear end behind a rock. You know, once you realize where she is, you're saying, oh, yeah, there's her furry rear end behind this rock. And you would look in that direction, and at first I thought, I wonder if that was coincidence. So then you try, again, this is where the repetitiveness comes in. You ask her the next time, where's Kutsi? And then she looks in the direction. And that kind of escalated, and then I realized she was pointing out where Kutsi was, and then even though then we got to the point with Kutsi, was even though I knew where she was, Kutsi wasn't about to come inside. So then frustration would grow, and I looked at Louise one day, and I said, go get Kutsi! And I point to her, and she actually went and down the hill, and she herded Kutsumatin up the hill by snapping very gently at the heels, at her heels, and Kutsi came up, her head was hanging, and obviously she was being told by Louise, she was being herded inside by Louise. And then again, you would repeat that request to see if it actually was what you thought it was. It's akin to if it's dinner time for your dog and you forgot, and your dog brings you his empty dish into the living room, and you immediately think to yourself, oh, yeah, I forgot to feed the dog. So you go into the kitchen, fill the dish full of food, put it down, and the dog eats, and that extinguishes the behavior. Well, if that happens once, you can say, well, that might have been coincidence. But if it happens over and over and over again, and it extinguishes the bringing the dish into the living room behavior, then you pretty much know you're onto something here. You are communicating with each other. But if you put the dish into the kitchen and fill it full of food, and the dog comes in, dumps the food, and brings the dish into the living room, and clearly that wasn't what he was after, right? You have to start over again and figure out something else. So it's what we do with our pets all the time. It's just repetitiveness so we can come to an understanding of how it's communication.
So then did Kutsi stop hiding from you over time, or no, just Louise would be the one to get her?
There was a time, Kutsumatin was growing older over the years, too. So as time went by, she became more adult, and she would stop hiding behind rocks her cub-like behaviors were curbed, and she would become more adult. She was actually kind of catapulted into adulthood when Skokie showed up, the big male from the wild, and she had to learn about breeding and dealing with a new bear, and she found out that she wasn't the focal point of the whole world. And these are things that cubs find out in the wild sooner as their mother takes them through the environment. So we brought this into the environment. Skokie was part of the Three Strikes You're Out program of the Canadian Wildlife Service, and so they were either going to kill him or they asked the Calgary Zoo. Nobody really wants to euthanize a bear in the wild. And so they asked the Calgary Zoo if we had room for him, if we could incorporate him into. And we felt that we did. And so that's when Skokie came in on the scene. And it's very interesting because Skokie was a wild bear. And that's when I realized Skokie really introduced me to the concept that wild bears and captive bears are exactly the same bear. They just have a different skill set. So a captive bear knows what it is to live in captivity and the comings and goings of that and the culture of living in captivity, and wild bears know wild bear culture. And Skokie learned both. He could do both. But he had some cultural things, like wild bears don't attack each other willy-nilly for no reason. And Kutsumatin, being a spoiled little brat cub, you know, who had been brought up in captivity. It wasn't her fault. I mean, obviously she had not been challenged like that before, would just jump on Skokie when it suited her. And Skokie, just, you could tell he was confused at times, and he would back away from her, and he just did not understand. He wasn't used to that from the wild. He just did not understand why this, you know, little female bear would be doing this. It made no sense. She was half his size. And he was, it was remarkable. He held back. He was such a gentle bear. And he held back, and Skokie's still there. He just very gentle animal, held back and held back and held back. And I just remember the day when he had finally had enough. He was walking down, they had a pretty good enclosure with a hill in it, and he was walking down the enclosure, and she came up, even from an attack perspective, this was a huge tactical error. She's coming up the hill, and she's attacking a bear twice her size. It made absolutely no sense. And he knew that, and he was just tired of this. You could just tell. And his response was, he stood still and watched her come charging, and she was huffing and puffing and snorting and spitting, and she was owly, and he took his paw. She's below him, but she finally got to the point where she almost impacted with him, and he took his paw, and he clipped her under her chin and flipped her backwards down the hill. And I mean, that had to hurt, even though she was a roly-poly ball of fat, but she just kind of rolled down the hill, and then she came to. Well, she didn't pass out. I don't mean to say that. She just kind of collected herself, I guess you could say, collected her sensibilities, and then she went into the pond and just sat there for the rest of the day. And I thought, yep, that seemed to be the lesson.
And you talk about these different skill sets, and you compare it to humans going camping. And I'd love for you to sort of tell us about captive bears versus wild bears and the different skill sets and how that might compare to how we think of our skill sets living in urban areas or other areas.
There's sort of a culture in humans to every skill set. If we live an urban life, we know not to today. I mean, it was different. Our culture was different even, 60 years ago. Today, we know not to open the door to strangers in the middle of the night. We know not to cross against the red lights because we'll get killed. we know not to do certain things, and we know to do certain things. We know if you live out on the farm, you know certain precautions that you take. If you're out in the field working, you need to bring water with you, or these days you can bring a cell phone with you in case something happens. You can call for help. If you're used to hiking in the wilderness, you know to bring bear spray with you, hopefully, and you know to take other precautions if you know what you're doing. So there is skill and culture to everything. If you're an astronaut, you know how to live in space. I have no idea, and I would die because I haven't learned any of that. Some people have learned to live with a disease, and all of their lives, and the rest of us can just look on them with awe and say to ourselves, I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you survive, but they do. With bears, it's the same thing. In captivity, you learn how to negotiate zookeepers. You learn how to negotiate the other animals in your enclosure. You learn how to avoid the veterinarian. In the wild, you learn how to fend for yourself. Your mother taught you where the berry patches are in your home range. She taught you where where the moth larvae are, when the salmon are spawning and when you can go eat there. When it's time to not hang around with big male grizzlies, when it's okay to, what other animals you can be near, who to chase, who not to chase, who's dangerous, who's not dangerous. Those are the skills of living in the wild.
You spend a lot of time helping bears in captivity live better lives. So I'm wondering if you could take us through some of the other experiences you've had. Tell us about some of the bears. I'm thinking, one of them is Miggy, who you talk about in your book, Smiling Bears. The American black bear cub who arrived motherless when you were working at the Detroit Zoo.
She was really quite a remarkable little animal, and she taught me a great deal. I think more than anything else, Miggy taught me that I came to understand beyond a shadow of a doubt that bears are completely and utterly convinced of being bears. There's no such thing as humanizing a bear. And you hear that statement periodically. Groups will say these bears are humanized because they spend X amount of time in captivity. they actually aren't humanized. They still have genetic expectations of being a bear. And in captivity, we have to follow behavior-based husbandry and meet those genetic expectations. So in order to house physically and mentally healthy bears. So Minmigi taught me that in a very unique and very effective way. Well, I won't say it's unique. I'm sure it's bear cubs will use that often with each other anyway. I'm not sure how well that would go over with their mothers. She would bite me and let me know to stop doing something. She would make little guttural noises, and then quick as lightning, she would give me a bite. And, of course, that would make me drop whatever it was I was doing. Sometimes she'd draw blood, and sometimes she wouldn't. And that bite served the purpose. It made me stop doing whatever it was that I was doing and watch her. And then she would demonstrate the correct way of doing it, which would be the bear way of doing it. And I think the first time that I was completely aware that we were on the same page, where I was completely aware of what it was she was doing, because she was going to be introduced to other bears when she was old enough, it was imperative that I be with her when she was eating and stuff. And we brought in, because she was from the wild, we had wonderful volunteers who helped with this, brought in nuts and so on. And I would sit with her and crack nuts with her. Now, I can't do it the bear way, but so I didn't want to use a nutcracker because I thought mechanically that's a little too human. And so I just did it with a rock. And we would be sitting there on the floor, and I would crack them with a rock. And then I would show her, just like a bear mom would show her cub, that there was something that for her to eat in the nut. I would crack them with a rock, and then she would eat what's in there. Well, one day she was in a mood, and I knew that from the beginning. I could tell she was just not her usual jovial self, and I thought, okay, well, we'll get over it. I tried to get her to play, and she wouldn't have any of it. And then I started cracking nuts, and she did that little guttural thing, and then like lightning, she bit my hand, and I just like, oh, the rock. And obviously my hand hurt, so I'd be annoyed, and I'd look at her, and, you know, what is it with you? And now she's smiling, which I thought was pretty funny. And
she was smiling here.
Oh, yes, she was. She's now smiling. And so she picked up a walnut, moved it to the back of her molars, crunched it, and spit it out in front of me. Didn't eat the nut part of it. She spit it out in front of me and sat back and smiled. And for me, the lesson was obvious. That's how you crack a nut. That's the bear way of cracking a nut. So after that, I thought, okay, she's now, her genetics have now kicked in. She's cracking her own nuts the bear way, so I'm not going to do that for her. And I wasn't about to use my molars to crack my nuts, so I decided to still use the rock, but she was okay with my doing it my way if it was for me. But she wasn't okay with my doing it my way if I was trying to give her the nuts, because she could do it now. It's kind of akin to a kid going, don't tie my shoes anymore. I can do it, and getting annoyed with mom trying to tie their shoes. You know, it's like, I can do it now, or maybe trying to slap at mom. You know, I can do it, kind of thing. So, yeah, that's when I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that's what this behavior was. It was her M.O. She would, whenever it was time for me to learn how to do it the bear way, she would bite me and let me know that she was clearly annoyed, and she had my attention at that point. And then I would watch her, and then she would show me bears again, communicate through demonstration, and she would show me how you do it the bear way. And then I would try to accommodate that if I could.
Were there cases where you could accommodate it? I mean, you couldn't bite a walnut.
But... No, I couldn't. Now that she knew how to bite her own nuts, then she would do it herself. But I would have to, I'd have to still use a rock. Because I made an error initially, I wouldn't bother eating with her because obviously I'd had breakfast at home. And so I was just showing her how to, that was initially, at the very beginning, I would just show her, you know, that there's meat inside these nuts that you can eat and this and that. But then over time I realized that she is going to have to, at that point she pretty much thought that, I thought it was possible that she would assume that all the food belonged to her, right? That whatever food that showed up in the captive community would be hers. And I thought, that's not good, because any bear that we introduce her to is going to want to eat as well. So So she had to learn that whole sharing thing. So I started sitting down and having nuts with her. And I'd have my pile, and she'd have her pile. And the very first day I did this, it was really funny. She would have her pile, and then I made a pile at the other end of the little room, and I would start cracking my nuts with the rock and just sit there, mind my own business, my own foraging business, and she would be over there cracking her nuts, but she was watching me. And she wasn't too keen on my eating nuts. So she got up from her pile, and she went over, and she, I was sitting cross-legged on the floor, and she took her little fat rear end and sat down right in front of me, in my lap, so I couldn't eat nuts. And she ate, and she ate my nuts. So I got up, left her at my pile, and I went over to her pile and started eating her. I took my rock with me and started eating her nuts. And then she was making these little guttural noises, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to get chewed. Any minute now she's going to bite me. But I went over and...
Were you scared? I mean, I'd be scared.
Well, no, there's a difference between, you know, being a... Oh, sure, it hurts, but there's a difference between just having a bite and drawing a little bit of blood than being eaten by a wild bear. Those are two different things. I mean, you know what the consequences are, and it was part of... And, I mean, there are folks who aren't interested in having that kind of interaction with bears, but I was far more interested in her learning how to be with bears so that we could integrate her into the community with bears so that she could live successfully in captivity.
So what happened when you went to her pile?
Oh, she came back. She's now grunting, you know, making these little guttural noises. At first it was whiny, and then it grew in intensity. And also, when bears are annoyed, they will make their upper lip either pointy or square. And I'd get this little, and the cubs are hilarious when they do it. There's this little pointy upper lip. They can do that. We can't. But so I'd get this little pointy upper lip of annoyance and plus the little guttural noises. And she came over, and she displaced me again from that pile. And then I went over to my pile quietly. I wouldn't say anything to her. I was just really determined to eat nuts. And then she walked off. We did this a couple of times, and finally she was just disgusted with me and the whole scenario, that she walked away down the hall, because we're in the keeper area, right? She had access to the keeper area when I was there. And she walked down the hall, like, just talking to herself with these little guttural grunts and talking to herself, and I thought it was kind of humorous, but I didn't smile because she would understand, I thought, she would understand that I was laughing at her, and I didn't want to do that. I just minded my own foraging business at my pile of nuts. And then, you know, a few seconds, and all of a sudden, she came charging down the hall. It was a cement floor. It was so funny. And she came careening through my pile of nuts, scattering the nuts everywhere. Like, that's what I think of your pile of nuts. And she just said, that was just the first day, and after that, she was used to it, that she understood that she had to share. What I did when she scattered the nuts throughout was I just went around and continued eating, right? I continued, you know, I gained a lot of weight that fall. It was just because I ate so many nuts.
So you just went ahead and gathered the nuts and ate them?
Yeah, I would just go wherever they had. I'd do it the bear way. Bears wouldn't gather them into a pile and then eat them. That might be a primate thing. But the bears would go wherever the nuts had fallen and then eat them there and just go from, you know, nut to nuts and pick them up and just eat them. So that's what I did the bear way. And she just eventually gave up. She just thought, oh, well, I guess you're eating them too, and I'll just eat mine. So, yeah, it was an interesting learning experience.
And you've also had some experience with spectacled bears.
Yeah, they're very, very interesting as well.
Which are we don't know too much about them.
No, there is some, and I wrote about that in the epilogue of Smiling Bears. There's a wonderful bear biologist working with spectacled bears in Peru right now. They're also called Andean bears. Her name is Robin Appleton, and she's doing some very interesting behavior work. She's just been following a female around with a cub that she had initially tagged, collared, who had a cub, and I'll really be looking forward to reading and hearing what she's a friend of mine, just hearing what she has to say about the spectacled bear behaviors and so on. She and I started collaborating because I had experienced behavior in captivity. And the thing about being a bear biologist is that you don't always get a chance to spend that kind of time or have that kind of interaction with bears in order to see what their behavioral complement actually is. So it really makes sense for us to all work together and share our experiences and see what we can test scientifically and find ways to, at the very least, catalog the behaviors that we're seeing. So that's going on now. And, so Robin Appleton's doing a lot of work in the wild, Peruvian.
In the captive setting, I mean, I know this was some time ago, but you write about a bear named Malanka?
Yeah.
And one of the things that helped her was you essentially got her a pet.
Yeah. See, I had not ever seen this before, ever. I would have said it was not possible. And, you know, every time you say something like that, they prove you wrong. Malanka, where she was in the back area, they had brought in some Vietnamese fishing cats to live next door. They didn't see each other, but Vietnamese fishing cats are actually very small wild cats. But they smell really big. And Malanka was a very shy bear, and so she could smell these cats.
And what Malanka do they smell like?
Like a really big tiger. And Malanka had in the past, before we started working with her, this was many years previous, she had been in an enclosure where she could see tigers and was really concerned about them. She didn't like them at all. She was really concerned about them. So I'm guessing that that's what brought on her serious pacing behaviors. She just would not stop pacing. It was day and night. And so I thought, I have to do something to get her, if she's annoyed or frightened or I... So I got her a bunch of goldfish, thinking that she would, and a kiddie pool in her back enclosures. And I thought that she might dive into the pool and chase after these goldfish and do something like that. But I was really shocked and amazed. She was, because the goldfish moved, so it'd be something to draw her attention away from this serious smell, in her mind, of the Vietnamese fishing cat. I have a house cat, incidentally, that's bigger than a Vietnamese fishing cat. It's they're that small. But anyway, she
so very
came
small,
in.
But have a huge odor.
Yeah, they have this very distinctive big smell. So Malanka came in. I had cleaned her back area and gave her access, and she noticed the pool, of course, and she noticed the movement in the pool, and of course I got her attention, and I was really excited because I was just watching her very quietly, minding my own business, someplace else, and she went over to the pool, sat down on her haunches, kind of like a dog does, and watched these goldfish move around, and when they stopped moving, I was actually waiting for her to pounce on them, when they stopped moving, she very gently picked up one of her paws and touched the surface of the water to create waves, little waves. And then the fish would move again, and she watched them move, and then she would repeat this behavior, and when they stopped moving, she would do that again. So it was very interesting, and I thought, I guess these fish are here to stay, which really surprised me, because it was after hours now, and I had no fish food, so I ran all over the place. The reptile people had gone home, because they were the ones who had fish, and I couldn't get fish food, and so I had some bread, and I thought, well, I have to feed these fish now, because clearly they're staying. So I got some bread that I had, and I threw that. That would tide them over until I could get real fish food the next morning, early the next morning. So I just needed to get them over the next few hours. And so I just shredded a little bit of the bread, and I threw it on top of the pool for the fish to come get. And the fish, sure enough, they came up to the top, and they would get, some of this whole wheat bread. And Malanka got up, from where she was sitting, and very gently ate all the bread on the surface. So I guess it was okay, the fish could stay, but they weren't allowed to eat anything. So that was pretty funny. So I had to feed the fish on the fly.
Really?
Yeah. But those fish survived many, many months. And she got into the habit of whenever I cleaned the back area, of course, I now had to dump this big pool and transfer the fish from one pool to the next. And it became a big thing, but she was very intense. She spent a lot of time watching her fish, and whenever she came into the enclosure after I had cleaned it and gave her access during the day, and she would check everything. I'd give her new straw and there'd be brows and enrichment and all kinds of different things. And part of her checking always involved a fish.
She'd oh, really? So what did she do?
She would just check and make sure. It was almost as if she was checking to see if each one was there. She would look at each one, and then she would run off and check her new straw and check other things as well. So it was very interesting.
So she never actually would feed the fish herself. I was going to ask you if she ever fed the fish.
No, I've never, ever seen that, no. No, and all I knew was I fed them on the fly, so I never took that any further, and no, I'd never seen anything like that at all, no.
Given all your experience, I'm wondering if you've noticed any overarching emotions or characteristics that vary among bears. While recognizing that bears are individuals, I'm wondering, noticed any sort of overarching emotions or characteristics between males and females? Or do different species have different behaviors or different emotions?
Most bear keepers will tell you this. There are differences between species. Polar bears, there isn't a lot that makes a polar bear fearful. And in the captive community, it's as if, and I'm just saying as if because I don't know, it's as if because they're seemingly on top of the food chain, they're genetically programmed for that. And grizzly bears, for instance, I've noticed, will argue and argue and argue a point with each other. They're loud, they're boisterous, they'll be demonstrative long before they ever impact and physically fight. They'll argue and argue, and they look like two prize fighters, you know, bopping back and forth without ever touching each other. Black bears, American black bears, I've noticed, impact much faster. Sometimes you'd get very little warning before an impact. There's kind of attitude or noise, and then boom, they can impact with you. Sometimes they'll argue, and it depends on what the issue is. It's all relative to the current circumstances, and again, that animal's history. Males, I've noticed over time, are generally not good nest builders. They will build nests, but they don't spend huge amounts of time on it. They're much more utilitarian. But having said that, I've met some males that build really extensive nests. females spend hours, can spend hours building nests. So there are definitely differences like that, sort of category of differences like that.
What has been the strangest characteristic you've observed or the strangest case you've worked on?
I think there is a behavior that I did not understand for years until I saw the behavior in Miggy numerous times, and it brought it all back to me like a flash. It brought back that I had seen Chrissy do it, Louise do it, dozens of other bears that I'd worked with do it, and that's paw biting.
And Miggy, bear, Miggy, tell
Miggy,
us about Miggy. She's
yeah.
the black bear cub we were talking about.
That's right. She's the little American black bear cub that was orphaned, and I spent so much time with her. She, going back to other bears that I've worked with, for instance, Kutsumatine had accidentally driven a spike up into her right paw, and I wasn't working with her at that time. The keepers came and got me from, because I had just finished that section, and so they knew that Kutsi would show me stuff, and so they came and got me from, I think I was on the Eurasia section, and so they came and got me from there, and they told me that they felt that Kutsi might have driven something into her paw, but they weren't sure. It could have just been a bee sting, and they weren't sure what was going on, and Kutsi would show me her paw. They knew that. I came up to the section, and Kutsumatine came over to me. She was obviously limping. Came over to me, and she was favoring, when she was limping, I noticed she was favoring her front right paw. So that's all sort of something that you unconsciously notice. But she sat down in front of me, and she put her front left paw in her mouth and very gently bit down on it. And I looked at her, and now I'm confused. I'm like, wait a minute, wasn't it your right paw? What's going on here? So anyway, I asked her for her paw, and thinking now that I had had it wrong, that it was her left paw, and she put her left paw down on the ground, and she showed me her right paw, and sure enough, she had driven a, there was little, looked like what was now a closed little hole, and there was, so they knocked her down and they pulled the little spike out of her paw, and she was fine after that. I clearly remember that, and then I remember other times that bears had been injured physically, and I had seen this paw biting, not repeated paw biting, just once. They're looking right at you, and when bears demonstrate something to you, they have eye contact with you, and then they'll demonstrate something, and I learned this over time. So now, it's years later, and I'm at the Detroit Zoo, and I'm raising Miggy, and I would go into her enclosure every day and clean up, and I had given Miggy a huge stuffed bear, and she dragged that thing all over the place. The only reason I had given that to her was out of desperation. She wasn't sleeping because I wasn't there 24/7, and she needed to rest. She was running around like a little pinball, and I needed something. So, and this is something that other people have reported worked with younger animals, is a plush, furry, fuzzy, sort of faux fur toy. And so I got her this ridiculously soft, cushy, stuffed, gigantic bear, and she dragged that, and it worked. She immediately fell, she grabbed this thing and dragged it into her nest area, which I didn't even think she recognized as a nest area. This was early on, and she fell asleep with it. And so she dragged this thing all over the place. She always knew where it was. One day I thought, oh, it was awful. I mean, she dragged this through piles of poop and urine and in her food, and it was all over the place. And you can just imagine how hideous it was. And one day I thought, okay, I have to throw this in the washing machine. And so it's like the last thing I grabbed on my way out after cleaning everything. And she started bouncing off my rear end. She's just a cub, right? So she started standing on her hind legs and bouncing with her forepaws off my rear end as I'm leaving. And that didn't work. I thought she wanted to play, because every moment is a good play moment when you're a cub. And so that didn't stop me. I couldn't play now. We'd done enough playing. I had to go. And so then she blocked my exit to the door, and she stood up on her hind. She was grumbling and being whiny, and she stood up on her hind legs again, and one of her paws grabbed onto my belt so she could maintain her balance. And she had actually been trying to pull this stuffed animal out of my hands. And I thought, no, I don't want to play tug of war. I want to leave. And, you know, that was how I was interpreting this. And it's like, no, you can't have it. I need to wash this thing. And so she stood up on her hind legs and balanced herself with one arm off my belt. And she put the other paw in her mouth and gently bit down, staring in my eyes. She looked like a sad, pathetic little creature, and it hit me. You hurt. This hurts. And it was like a flash. All of these other incidences with adults came back to me. Kutsumatine came back to me. All of the other incidences. It was like this flash of lightning, and I went, I get it. It's not just that you hurt physically. You hurt if I take this thing away from you. You hurt. So there was an emotional hurt. That's how I interpret it. And so at first I thought, you're crazy. Me, personally, I'm crazy. But I saw it repeated. And what I did was I obviously snuck, you know, I left the animal, the stuffed toy, with her. And then I would take it off when she wasn't watching and wash it and bring it, sew it up, because it was losing stuffing as well, and bring it back. And, you know, it was eventually met its demise down the road. But that was when I started putting this together. And then I thought, you know, I kept that to myself for a long, long time, because it's the kind of thing that no one's ever going to believe. A, even the idea that the animal's communicating physical pain to you, but it's a stretch for humans, especially in the scientific field, to believe that they recognize emotional pain, right? So I kept that to myself for a long time. Then I met up with Ben Killam. He's a wonderful bear rehabilitator who lives in the United States, and he's an author of a book called Among the Bears, and he's been with many American black bear cubs, and I talked to him, and he has recorded exactly the same behavior, and he interprets it exactly the same way.
Interesting.
Yeah. Oh, it is, yeah.
Did the clean toy So was it as good, or did she reject it once it was cleaned?
Oh, no, she was fine with that. I'd clean it, bring it back. It had to happen really quickly. It was in the washing machine, and then you got to put it in the dryer, and then you got to sew it up really fast and then get it back in there. But she would miss it, right? And she had one human who was in there as often as I could be. I mean, she was a cub who was supposed to move into adulthood. So it was really important that she had that stuffed toy in there. Yeah, so she would miss it. But, she would accept it clean, absolutely.
And if people are interested in bears, you know, I wanted to close by asking why it's so important to help bears and what people can do to help. And I do want to mention that you say in your book, Smiling Bears, that some of the proceeds from the sale of Smiling Bears is donated to a number of different organizations.
That's right. Some of the proceeds are donated to the organizations that I talk about in the book, in the epilogue, to help their work. The best way is for any one of us can help. If there's bears in your community, if you live in an area where there's wild bears, then see if there's a bear rehabilitator. See if there's a local zoo that has bears. So you can help locally, or you can help by getting involved in groups that are active in wild bear conservation locally that talk about doing smart things like not having bear attractants in your backyard, like fruit trees and hummingbird feeders and bird feeders and barbecues and garbage and small poodles on a chain and things like that. You don't want to have bear attractants in your backyard. You don't want to have your small children out there in your backyard. And you can get involved like that and talk about people, if they go hiking into the backcountry, that they need to bring bear spray and that kind of thing. So there's many ways to get involved locally, and also you can get involved internationally with some of the big groups like Animals Asia, who've been working very effectively with rescuing Asiatic black bears from the bear bile trade in China, getting them away from the farms. Or you can work with Polar Bears International. There are many, many organizations. Really, you just have to Google bears, and all kinds of organizations will pop up. And all the work is good work. It all matters.
And in fact, in your book, Smiling Bears, you list a number of organizations which are dedicated to various species of bears.
That's right. In the back of the book, I have a list there of organizations where you can do work that really matters. There are organizations that are really grassroots, like Robin Appleton's work, where she's trying to set up a conservation area down in Peru to save the desert spectacle bear habitat there and the bears in it. And there, your dollar goes right to work. Not a penny is wasted. It goes right to work in terms of the conservation efforts. And, you know, Animals Asia, same thing. Very little money goes towards administration. They have a huge rescue center just outside of Chengdu in the province of Sichuan in China, which is fairly close to the Tibetan border. They've just opened a new rescue center in Vietnam. So they definitely need your help, and they're an extremely credible, remarkable organization. So there's lots and lots to do.
And in fact, on The Wildlife, I've interviewed Jill Robinson, the head of Animals Asia Foundation, so people can check out the podcast of that as well. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me today. It's just been wonderful, and I look forward to hearing more stories.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on. I very much appreciate any opportunity to talk about bear conservation and welfare.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about bears with bear expert Elsa Polson, author of Smiling Bears. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call comes from a common mammal that lives throughout North America. It comes from one of the 8 bear species that we've talked about today. Do you know it yet? It's the North American black bear. Listen to the sounds of a black bear.
Thank you.
Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.